thank you, Judith, for your kind words, and thank you so much for this invitation to talk at the seminar. I wanted to share some data from a recent ethnography that I did at a Finnish university. This is indeed part of the language regulation in academia project, so that sort of explains the focus on language brokering here. In our project, we've looked at various ways in which writing at university, particularly in L2 English, is regulated both top-down and in more local ways. And my study then focused on administrators, who I think are a group that doesn't get a lot of attention, either from university management or from us researchers. What I'll be looking at today is the work of a team of nine administrators who worked on a high-stakes genre, which was the focus of a new language policy at this university. There is, of course, quite a lot of research on multilingual writing also in the workplaces, but I think less work on such very regulated genres. So this is not a creative, innovative type of writing at all. It's more repetitive, but also at the same time, it's clear that the writers feel this is a very demanding kind of writing that they do. The sort of starting point was that I wanted to study the writing practice of administrators. This genre that I'll be looking at is collaboratively produced, so this is also a collaborative negotiation over both work practices and language choice, but then also what kind of language is acceptable in this new situation. So multilingual writing in the sense that my participants were regularly in the position of having to write in two languages instead of one, which had been their routine earlier. The genre that I'm looking at today is meeting agendas for faculty council meetings. Why meeting agendas? For these writers, for these administrators, using English at work was not unusual at all. It was routine, but it was more informal genres than formal ones like this that they tended to produce, so emails and perhaps something for the internet. But this genre turned out to be more demanding in terms of what kind of an impact it had, and the new language policy that sort of changed things for them was came into force in early 2022 and put them in a position where they suddenly had to produce meeting documentation in Finnish and English rather than just Finnish. So faculty councils are in the Finnish system, they are the key forum for university democracy in the sense that they tend to have representatives from all staff groups as well as students, and they tend to decide on relatively important things like the awarding of degrees and titles and the teaching programs, the curricula. They select the dean, they decide on admissions. So it was felt that especially in faculties which have a lot of staff who don't know Finnish, this new language policy was rationalized by saying we can't exclude this number of people from decision making, and therefore Finnish and English need to be used in the documents. Now, as you can imagine, for administrators, this was a quite a decision in terms of their everyday work. They had done this work in Finnish only until this time, and I guess we might expect a degree of language brokering to happen. In the sense that these people were all L1 Finnish speakers, so they were writing in a language that, while they did use it at work, they didn't use it for this sort of purpose. So, just to give you a bit of context, the university's language policy supports three languages. So, Finland is a bilingual country with Finnish and Swedish, but English has been part of the university for a long time now, given the mobility of both staff and students. This language policy for faculty councils came in 2022. And said things like agendas and minutes will be drawn up in parallel in Finnish and English. Also, about the language to be spoken at meetings, the policy said that the language should be agreed by the council in their first meeting, just to see what languages need to be used so that everyone can participate. I won't go into meeting language today, but it's, as you can imagine, not an easy issue either. What I guess I need to say as well is that the Finnish version was declared primary. So if, for example, the two language versions were deemed not to say the same thing, then the Finnish version would be the legally binding one. Here you can see a photograph from the campus library, so you can see the trilingual language policy at work. So this is a typical sort of thing to see in the linguistic landscape, the three languages side by side. At this particular faculty and campus, about a third of teaching and research staff are categorized as international, so it was one of the first faculties to start implementing this language policy. And they decided to use English as a spoken language in their first meeting in January 2022. So it is the kind of language scenario is monolingual meetings and bilingual meeting documentation. Just a note before I start sort of talking about my orientation a bit more. This might explain why I think this perspective of language brokering is relevant here. In the interviews with my participants, the way they talked about the meeting agendas and minutes as genres suggested that they put a lot of emphasis on things like correctness, precision, transparency, and so on. So this is the faculty council secretary, who was one of my key participants, saying it's an official document, it gets archived and so on. I want it to be as high quality as possible. A second administrator described her concern about whether the language version is as pretty as the Finnish one. So they were concerned about bad English in the minutes. And these are just two examples of sort of multiple interviews where this was raised. So as I said, it was quite stressful for the administrators to be put in this position, but it was not just about the amount of work that the language versioning created, but also their concern about whether they were competent to produce these texts for the agendas and the minutes. So I think for today, it's important to recognize that that's the same normative orientations held for both language versions. So they weren't thinking that because Finnish is legally primary, it doesn't matter what the English version looks like. They also felt quite a lot of pressure to produce language versions in English that were as good as possible. Now, just to show you a snippet from an actual agenda, the policy said that both language versions needed to be in the same document, so you couldn't have two different documents in different places. So this is what it looked like. This is an item regarding the awarding of the title of docent. So you can see the languages there side by side. So this layout was decided by the team of administrators. Also, the choice of blue for the English version or the English translation. And you can see that the language changes very frequently. So this could have, of course, been done in a different way. For example, one paragraph in Finnish and then another paragraph in English, or the whole item in Finnish and then in English, but they decided to do it differently. I can also say that the presentation followed this understanding whereby the English language version sort of duplicates the Finnish language version in terms of content, so parallel texts following Mark Sebber's classification. So content ideally equivalent here. And the visual cues were there to supposedly help the reader find the version that they want to be reading. So separate rather than flexible bilingualism, and I'd also argue that you could apply this idea of bilingualism as parallel monolingualisms to this data. Clearly, there are two language versions intended for different audiences. They are not mixed at any point, and prescriptive norms affect the production of both language versions. You can see another snippet there at the bottom, at the sort of towards the end of 2022, my data collection, they decided to shift from blue to gray. So there were debates at the faculty regarding how the layout should be and how you should cue visually the English language version. But this varies a lot across the whole university. It's quite interesting in itself. Now, about my orientation, theoretically speaking, generally I would describe this as in the field of sociolinguistics of writing. Particularly Teresa Lillis's work has been important for our project. So looking at writing as networks of activity, bound up with contexts of production, distribution, and evaluation. So I'll be looking at the collaborative process of producing agendas today, but also evaluation comes in a lot given our focus on language brokering. And for us, this idea that language norms are dynamic is very central. So we are not, and it's very clear from my data that this is not a scenario where there is an external authority who imposes norms of acceptability from top down. It's clearly negotiated collaboratively. It's often negotiated very locally as well. So literacy brokering is a central term for us. Briefly defined, we can see it as a methodology or as an approach where we track the impact of actors other than authors on text production. So in my case, this was a team of administrators who collaborated within the team, but there was also a lot of sort of external input, as you can imagine, in this new situation. So for us, it's important to track who takes on the role of broker, who is given the role of broker. It's not a simple situation, even though you might be interested to know that this university, in fact, had a central language services unit. So this could have been simply a process of having these language professionals do the language work, but that didn't happen. The notion of text history is also central. So again, influenced particularly by Teresa Lillis's work, methodology for empirically tracking the drafting and redrafting of written texts across time for exploring the impacts of literacy brokers. So I've what the, my extracts or my examples that I will be showing today are from four meetings, text histories construed for four meetings. So this is drafts of meeting agendas, discussions around those drafts, different episodes of brokering that happened during the writing process. I'll just briefly describe the data that I've collected so that you can see what the discussion is based on. Interviews were conducted with a couple of key participants multiple times, but I've talked to all of the team members at least once. There are 11 meetings that I've documented in terms of the drafts of agendas. Very interesting type of data for me were the preparation meetings between it was the administrators and the dean as chair, and they discussed the draft agenda. And it was quite typical that they would raise some language issues during that meeting. Final versions of the texts, observation notes from the faculty council meetings, and of course the meeting minutes themselves. Quite a lot of correspondence with the administrators. I need to say also something about my role. I started collecting data in January 2022. This is when I was promised access. They were also quite interested to have a researcher look at how this shift from monolingualism to multilingual agendas would work. But after the first meeting with a team of administrators, I was sent this email from the faculty council secretary. She had heard that I was working as a lecturer in an English unit, so assumed that I was a specialist in English, and thereby wanted to give me this role of broker. So I was wondering whether you could read the agenda quickly, mainly the first pages. I'm so unsure about prepositions and articles. I would feel safer if they were correct. Now, I of course didn't feel in a position to say no to this query, and it in fact turned into a very sort of interesting process, because through helping the faculty council secretary with a number of things during the year, I also got access to quite a lot of stuff that I wouldn't have heard about otherwise. So while of course it is a challenge to be also acting as broker in this data, it was also, I think, a very productive thing for me. But of course, as I hope you agree, it was ethically sort of impossible to think of sort of being allowed access to this setting and then saying I'm just going to observe from the sidelines. Okay, now just before I show you any extracts, detailed extracts from the data, I'll just describe the stages in the writing process from the perspective of when brokering happened typically. So this is based on all the 11 meetings that I have data from. So it started with the administrators individually writing their own items for the agenda. And what I've marked here in red is a place where brokering can happen. Doesn't always happen, but typically a place for that. They produced both language versions on their own. So this was not a situation where they would typically send anything to be translated by an external party. They could seek language support in some ways, but they didn't typically have a translator involved here. The monthly meetings were preceded by a very regular cycle of things happening in the team of administrators. So Mondays or Tuesdays, the administrators added the texts that they had written to a shared document in Teams. And Tuesday evening, the secretary checked the full draft. So the secretary of the faculty council was a very central participant here. She collected the text, but she also monitored the texts for both language choice and the kind of so checking that both language versions were there, but she also occasionally intervened in some details in the texts. So she put the text together, sent it to the team of administrators, and Wednesday mornings they then met for a preparation meeting with the dean, discussed the draft, and as I said, language issues were often taken up there. So brokering happening during the meeting. I was then involved in language checking by invitation by the secretary. That would happen after the preparation meeting. The final version of the agenda was sent to members of the faculty council on Thursday, and on Tuesday they met for the actual meeting, during which sometimes people also pointed to issues in the agenda text, which could then be corrected for the meeting minutes. But the preparation of the minutes was also a process where all sorts of brokering might happen in terms of how to word decisions made at the meeting, for example. Okay, I'll just present now five different brokering examples of brokering. This is obviously not all the types that I was able to identify, but some types which give us some idea of this issue of who takes on or is assigned the role of broker, what sort of language features are targeted, and what sort of sources of norms are construed as being relevant. So on the whole, the by far the most frequent type of language feature that was targeted in these episodes was terminology. And typically, I think, which is interesting, most of the things that were discussed were relatively limited things. So linguistic features within the sentence. So they didn't talk about stuff beyond the sentence level, really. But mostly terminology, sometimes spelling, occasionally things like is this verb form okay or not, but relatively limited in scope. Here we have an example of a A5 seeking language support regarding an issue to do with spelling. So they were writing an item for the agenda in May, and they wanted to ask a relatively limited question about the spelling conventions in English. They sent a question to a Teams channel. This visual here is from a screen shot from the first page of the Teams channel. This was a Teams channel set up by the university's language services unit, where administrators could send queries about, it could be about terminology, it could be about other conventions. They could send a couple of sentences for translation, but very limited things. So this was not a way of commissioning translations, but they could ask for advice on anything to do with these faculty council documents. So this was set up because the university management felt that administrators needed this sort of support with their writing. So she sent a question to this channel. And the question is as follows: if the name of a discipline has two parts, is it better to spell the second part using initial capitals or lowercase? The brief answer from the language services units was that if it's a reference to a discipline, then lowercase, but if it's a title or a department, then initial capitals. And what was typical of these kinds of brokering is that the administrator made the choice of whether they needed to seek help, where they would seek help, and they also tended to take the proffered norm into use immediately without any negotiation, as here. So this kind of convention had to do with a number of different items that the A5 tended to write for the agendas, and she took it to use also for all her future writing. Okay, now the next example is about a process I'm sure is familiar to most of you. So you're probably not surprised to hear that a lot of the, or I think most of the administrators that I've talked to as part of my project talked about their use of machine translation services. And this is an example of A3, whose preferred service was DeepL. So when she produced the translation of, I mean, she first wrote the Finnish text for the items that she needed to include in the agenda, and then she used DeepL to produce a translation. Now, for her, this was a way of speeding up her work. This was not about her not being able to produce a translation, but it clearly sped up things. And there was a lot of work with these agendas anyway. So, but it was not just for agendas that she used DeepL. But again, you will not be surprised to hear that she reported that translation always needs correcting. Now, the reason was not that DeepL was producing English that was somehow not good enough, generically speaking, but it was not using the specific terminology for technical things agreed at this university. So she had to bring this translation in line with local institutional norms. These norms were ones that had originally been established by the Language Services Unit through glossaries and things, but A3 was a very experienced administrator, and I think for her it was more an established sense of what we use here at the university, entrenched via repetition. These were terms that she would regularly use in other genres as well. So examples here for Finnish valintalautakunta to do with admissions, DeepL would suggest selection committee, and the local norm was admission board. So she regularly revised that in the translations. Same for Finnish johtoryhmä, DeepL says steering group, the local norm was program board. So this was a regularized sort of brokering that she engaged in when using DeepL. So there's a sort of generic norm coming from DeepL, but then a local institutional norm overrides that here. A third example to do with brokering that was impacted in some ways by this local institutional norm coming from the language services units. This was an example where the secretary of the faculty council decided to revise the agenda to align with a centralized template. Now, this was an example of, again, as I said, the secretary of the faculty council was quite concerned about the quality of the agendas from the very first interview that I had with her. Interestingly, this template was not published until October 2022. When they had already been producing agendas for many months. But she still felt that now that this centralized template was available, she needed to start putting it to use. What the template brought was not very dramatic differences or revisions. So as you can see here, two examples that she decided to revise. They used to use the translation substitute member, changed into deputy member. They used the translation specialists that turned into experts. Now, this might seem a bit trivial as a revision, but again, here the rationalization was that these translations, deputy member and expert, were ones that had been used in prior translations at the university, and therefore starting to use those in the faculty council agendas would bring uniformity across the university. So this was a rationalization again where the local institutional norm was established as important, despite the fact that there are no problems in terms of intelligibility or otherwise with the use of substitute member or specialist. So this template was made available in order to allow administrators to use ready-made wordings for items that would typically occur in agendas across the university in any kind of meeting agenda. So again, both to potentially speed up their work, make things a bit easier, but also to bring uniformity to this genre across different settings. But you could equally well imagine administrators completely ignoring this template. This template was not imposed in any way. You could use it if you wanted to. Right. Then a couple of examples from preparation meetings, as I said, very interesting forum for language discussions. This is again about terminology. So the text that they, I'll show an extract from the meeting interaction, and the text they are discussing is at the very beginning of a meeting agenda where the participants of the meeting are listed. The item that was in focus was the translation of the title for A4. So it had been translated as training officer, and the dean was not happy with that. So here is an extract translated from Finnish. So the dean identifies what he thinks is a language issue in line one. Just a moment, koulutussuunnittelija, it's not training officer, is it? Turns to A3, who is the specialist in teaching administration, and therefore maybe the dean feels that it's her field. A3 immediately suggests an alternative term, education coordinator, but then decides that she needs to check with A4, whose title this is. Do you have your own? The dean is so happy with this term that he immediately starts revising the agenda on the screen. A4 seems to be fine with this alternative, acknowledges that there seem to be different versions in use, but education coordinator was the one that his predecessor had used in this context. We can go ahead and use that. So they all seem to agree that education coordinator is a good term, whereas the term training is evaluated as a bit odd. You start thinking about sports, says A3. Meanwhile, in the Zoom chat, other things are happening. So A2 is writing in the chat, directing a question to me. Anna, do you have any thoughts about how we should decide which is the correct alternative? So she's sort of expressing a generic question on the assumption that these terminological issues will keep coming up. She did a quick staff search in the internet while the discussion was ongoing and found lots of training officers and no education coordinators. So saying again, should we conform to something that other people seem to be doing? I'm not happy with being given this role of broker. I had no idea what the terminology would be, sort of in terms of what the university norm would be at that point. So I said, what about consulting the language services? What is interesting then, a bit of discussion goes on there about alternative terms, but at the bottom here, you can see A1 concerned about getting a decision. This A1 is the faculty council secretary who, as I said, was responsible for getting a revised version out the following day. So she didn't want to engage in long discussions. She wanted a decision, and the decision comes from A3. We, education coordinator, all of us use it. So she's here sort of establishing the fact that it's used within the faculty, within their team, as a rationale for choosing that term. External authorities are not really an issue here. Nobody's suggesting that in the meeting we should be consulting a glossary, and everybody sort of then concurs with A3 that all of us using it is a good enough reason for going for education coordination. My final example is another example from a preparation meeting where A9, an administrator, is concerned about what they have written for the agenda, particularly the English versions. This was A9's first meeting, and she seems to have had some concerns, wanted to get a collective response to the translations that she had produced. Now, there are two episodes here. I've only got the second one as an extract here, but A9 had asked about a text The dean had not attended very thoroughly, but had quickly read it and evaluated it as acceptable, saying it seems fine. 4 minutes later, A9 had another piece of text that she wanted people to look at. And she used an identical wording to the earlier one. If there's something in the language, we can still correct it. And the dean now notices that maybe some more time needs to be spent given the concerns of A9. But when A9 responds with, "I wrote it while I was a little bit ill with the flu," she then seems to start sort of minimizing, maybe this is not such a big problem, it's quite short, probably it's comprehensible. But the dean then reads the text and evaluates it using the same adjective, comprehensible. Now, what I find is interesting here, first of all, they're not really, unlike in the previous examples, they're not really focusing on any individual linguistic item or type of convention. It's more a generic thing like intelligibility. Another thing which was recurrent in these meetings is that typically it was the dean who self-selected as broker. And the dean is not a language specialist, but was chairing the meeting and presumably then in that role felt that that he was the one who should be attending to questions regarding language issues as well. But again, here, no external authorities are referred to as potential brokers, and nobody is using evaluations like it looks correct or it looks like good English. So it's what is collectively evaluated as intelligible that seems to be the norm here. And what I also need to say is that no revisions result. So the text stays as it is. Okay, so these examples show very different orientations, I think, to both this issue of who acts as broker at what point and what sources of norms are established as relevant. This is a sort of graph that tries to represent these different sources of norms that come up in these brokering episodes. I'd say that the most generic norm comes from, first of all, the machine translation services, as I said, widely used, but also myself as a researcher acting as broker, given that I had no access to any local institutional norm like the language services unit would put forward. The local norms, local institutional norms would be proffered by the language services unit, both in the form of this Teams channel, the templates they produced, the glossaries they had, and thereby the entrenched sort of terminology that the writers described following. But then you also had very local evaluations of what is good enough English in the sense that there were multiple episodes, especially in the preparation meetings, where there was sort of an evaluation where something that we use here in our unit is fine, or what we evaluate here as comprehensible is fine. Also references to if nobody complains, then it's fine. So there were a lot of situations where no external authorities were referred to or sourced. So language brokering was either sought locally or not sought at all. So as you can see, a wide variety of sources of norms, a wide variety of types of brokers. Certainly not all brokers were in any way language experts. So maybe the typical type of broker would be the language editor at the language services unit, but they were not sought regularly. So in terms of conclusions, I think it's very interesting that the administrations have the agency to decide whether they need help. So nobody's imposing help, despite the fact that there are these language services. They also have agency to decide where they should be seeking help. So I didn't really observe situations where people would be told off for problems in their text and told to seek help. That didn't happen at all. Instead, what I think was very salient is that they expressed a sense of collective responsibility for the quality of language, but it was also something that they sort of owned in a way. So it wasn't that they felt that it didn't matter what the English versions looked like, but they didn't talk as if they needed somebody, some language professional to always help them with the writing. Evaluations of what is good enough English were often made locally. So it wasn't a systematic practice to seek an external validation. Also negotiated via collaboration and dialogue, that was clear. So not in terms of finding and just taking on, first of all, seeking brokering from an external source and then putting that into use. A lot of negotiation happened also when they were seeking, if they were seeking help from external parties. So clearly, language professionals and other institutional authorities were not the only sources of norms construed as relevant or useful as part of this practice. I think this is instructive both in terms of showing the complexity of the writing processes in this particular team, what it means when they start doing writing in two languages, but also that maybe our prototypical assumptions about what happens during these processes are maybe not correct, as in the number of different participants and the variety of different brokers and the variety of places where that brokering can happen is really, really diverse and I think deserves attention. So here are my references. Thank you very much for your attention.